I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway, and we begin today with the sounds of a tragic and distressing experience that's become far too common for so many in our country.
911, what is the address of your emergency? Okay, tell me exactly what happened.
I don't know. I found a kid overdose. I had some Narcan in my car, so I tried giving it to him, but it didn't work. He's on the side of the railroad tracks.
Second 40, kick in, I got another bottle right here.
Go, go.
Allie?
Yeah.
Here, give him this.
Okay.
Okay.
I do have the police.
What the
f did
you just do, man?
Away. 3 hits of it so far.
Okay. I just gave him, we gave him 3 hits of Narcan. I don't know the kid. I don't know who he is. I don't know how old he is.
This is what it sounds like to try to save the life of someone who's overdosing on an opioid. And this particular experience comes from the documentary series Dope Sick Nation by Vice TV. But harrowing moments just like this one have become part of daily life in rural communities, small towns, and big cities. According to the CDC, more than 850,000 people have died from drug overdoses in America during the past 2 decades. And the numbers have increased sharply in recent years. In 2019, overdoses claimed nearly 71,000 lives, and during the first year of the pandemic, that number rose to 100,000 deaths. Synthetic opioids are driving these brutal numbers, accounting for nearly 3/4 of all fatal overdoses. The opioid emergency is a human catastrophe, but it's also an economic market, responding to supply, demand, innovation, and changing conditions. Now, if you're a little rusty on your Econ 101, just remember that in general, low supply and high demand makes prices rise, whereas plentiful supply and steady demand should make prices fall. But in the opioid market, something else seems to be at play. Let's start with the price of heroin. In the early 80s, a gram of pure heroin cost just over $2,000. Today, the same amount costs about $500. And if you're looking to get a high, buying a bag of heroin will run you just $5. I mean, it's easy to spend twice that much for a daily hit of Starbucks. So I hope you're asking, but wait, what? How could there be such a dramatic price decrease when demand is so high? With more people using, shouldn't heroin cost more? Well, the answer to that is innovation. Heroin is much cheaper today because it is now much cheaper to make. In 1985, producing heroin meant waiting for poppies to grow, harvesting and processing them, then transporting the product across international borders. Today, with a relatively simple setup and a combination of widely available chemicals, you can create cheap, powerful, synthetic opioids, namely fentanyl. And fentanyl just might be the one part of the American supply chain that has not broken in the pandemic. Demand for opioids is high, but the supply of cheap, potent, synthetic fentanyl has kept pace with the demand, so prices are low. But there is one rapidly rising cost in this market: the price of naloxone. This is not a drug used to get high. This is a drug used to save lives. And you probably know naloxone by its common brand name, Narcan. Now, naloxone is miraculously effective at reversing the effects of an overdose. And when administered swiftly, it nearly always prevents death. And because naloxone has been FDA approved since 1971, it's now off patent. It should be cheap. 10 years ago, it was. You could get a life-saving single dose of naloxone for about $1. Prices are very different today. Even before the pandemic, the New England Journal of Medicine reported price increases of 100 to 500% depending on the formulation and method of delivery. And last week, reporting from The Guardian detailed a continued spike in naloxone prices. In other words, if you want to make big profits in today's opioid market, you're much better off selling naloxone than selling heroin. For more on this, let's talk with Melody Schreiber, a contributor to The Guardian US and editor of the book, What We Didn't Expect, Personal Stories About Premature Birth. Melody, it's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us is Dr. Navarun Dasgupta, Senior Scientist and Innovation Fellow at the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health. Dr. Dasgupta, welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, I want to begin with you, Dr. Dasgupta. What is naloxone, or Narcan, as I think many of us sort of commonly know it?
So someone overdosing on strong pain meds like heroin will go still like they're falling asleep. These drugs act on the part of the brain that controls the will to breathe, like our most fundamental companion from birth. The drug that is naloxone is something that I call the anti-funeral drug. It helps people stay alive and prevent overdoses. The antidote kicks heroin out of the brain, restoring the desire to breathe instantly. When I've given it, people were breathing again in 2 minutes. If you give it to someone once by mistake, it doesn't do any additional harm. It's as close to a miracle drug as you can get. Frontline public health workers have been distributing it to people who use drugs since 1996. They've given out more than 6 million doses. Last year, 1.3 million doses alone. We can document that there are hundreds of thousands of people alive today because of this life-saving intervention. It's the anti-funeral drug.
All right. I want to take one more beat on this so that I understand, because you were talking about healthcare professionals and frontline workers giving it to those who are experiencing overdoses since the 90s, but it's been around since the 70s. What was it initially created for? What was the initial sort of on-label purpose?
So it was initially discovered by someone named Jack Fishman, who was trying to find a way to have less constipation from opioids. It turned out that this medicine actually works even better at reversing the overdose and letting people breathe again. So for the first decade or two, it was used mostly in the operating room for helping anesthesiologists bring people back to consciousness after surgery. It was eventually after that emergency personnel started using it in the hospitals, and then eventually it came out into ambulances as well.
Got it. Thank you. Now, Melody, I was talking in the introduction about this sort of bizarre reality where the price of things like heroin has dropped precipitously over the same period, sort of since the mid-1980s, but that now the price of naloxone is absolutely skyrocketing. I've got some theories about it, but you're the researcher here. Help me to understand in your reporting why these prices are soaring.
Well, so first of all, I know prices went up, I think you mentioned in the intro at the before the pandemic. Right now, the company that makes Narcan says that they actually haven't raised the price since they introduced it to the market. It came in high because of the way that it's administered. But the problem is the companies making more affordable naloxone have had some manufacturing issues. So the people who need it the most are not able to access an affordable version of the drug. They have to go by the brand name, and that's 30 times higher than what they've been paying.
And Melody, is that primarily about the route of delivery, or is there actually something different about the Narcan brand name versus the generic naloxones?
Narcan uses kind of an inhaler. You put it in your nose, and that's a different delivery than injectable naloxone. But I mean, it's a pretty basic nasal spray, essentially.
Dr. Dasgupta, do you want to weigh in on the formulation of the generic versus the name brand here?
Sure. So part of what complicates the simple supply and demand picture is that we don't really have a free market for naloxone in the United States. Instead, we have this Byzantine system where money from the federal government goes to states through an arcane formula. Legislatures and health departments get involved and pick a couple of programs in each state to fund. The on-the-ground programs get the money, then they need a doctor to write a prescription. Then corporate compliance officers require the doctor to get an affidavit for that prescription. The programs place an order with one medical supply company, then have to purchase it from a second distributor, and then finally it goes back to the program to distribute. So every step along this way is a reason for someone to say no. And because of this process, what should be $2.50 to make a naloxone kit ends up not being available to all the programs that can do the last mile delivery and get the drug to where it needs to go.
Now, Melody, as part of this sort of big story of sort of how it goes from production to actually saving lives, right, being the anti-funeral drug on the ground for folks, tell me about the OSNN.
The OSNN has a buyer's club to help harm reduction groups purchase naloxone with an agreement with Pfizer, and I believe with agreements with other pharmaceutical companies, generics, even the company that makes Narcan. So the OSNN helped negotiate this deal with Pfizer in 2012 to purchase naloxone at a greatly reduced price. Dr. Kuduskup, to tell me what I'm getting wrong here.
Sure. You got that pretty much right. So in 2012, Dan Bigg and I negotiated this deal with Pfizer to get us very affordable naloxone to the 110 programs that are responsible for reaching the most difficult to reach populations, the programs that have the most trust with the communities that need the naloxone the most. The Buyers Club facilitates those contracts. And so for the last decade, we've only had Pfizer as our supplier. So in April of this year, Pfizer had a manufacturing problem at the one factory in the country where they used to make naloxone. That essentially created a shortage of the cheap, affordable naloxone that these programs had been relying on and had used to buy about 6 million doses of naloxone. So we ended up with having to find other sources of naloxone. The company that makes nasal Narcan, the brand name, the $75 product, when we talked to them, they literally laughed at us and told us not to put the request in writing. So we went looking for other companies who would be more compassionate. And in doing so, we found one company that already made a generic version of the liquid injectable naloxone. And they have given us 50,000 doses for free, and we've distributed them already in 2 weeks. And we're working with them to manufacture a few hundred thousand doses more at a greatly discounted price that programs can actually afford, not the $75 nasal spray.
So what does this look like, Melody, on the ground with harm reduction groups? What do these rising prices mean for them?
To put it quite simply, as one source did, if something costs 30 times more than it did before, that means that you're saving one life instead of 30 lives. I mean, that's as simple and basic as you get it. Because of these price issues, more people are dying, thousands more people.
Is this a carve-out moment? Is this something surprising within pharmaceuticals and that market in general? Or do we typically see, I mean, I'm just saying, I was in the hospital with my mother, who is, in her 70s during the pandemic. She was in for another reason. But, I mean, suddenly Tylenol in the hospital costs much, much more. So I'm wondering, if sort of soaring prices is normal or if there's something specific here about this drug.
So there is something very specific here that's happening that hasn't really been acknowledged. And that's the difference in regulation between what's happening at the federal level versus the state level. On the state level, naloxone is basically treated as over-the-counter. State legislatures and through standing orders and other kind of directives have made it so that naloxone can be distributed by anyone and doesn't carry the same penalties as other prescription drugs. Now, on the federal level, on the national level, FDA still considers this a prescription drug. So you have to have a single physician for every order of naloxone that each of these programs place. What happens is that the corporate compliance officers at the pharmaceutical companies, at the pharmaceutical distributors, are compelled to treat this like a prescription drug and keep it locked away in that pharmaceutical system. This is so acute. You asked about the inventors of naloxone. So Dr. Fishman, who invented naloxone, his stepson died of a heroin overdose because, in part, he could not get access to the medication he invented to save that life because it was a prescription drug. We're at this point where the prescription requirement on a federal level is the root of all evil when it comes to getting more naloxone out to where it needs to go. Until we can get parity and resolution between the way states want this medicine to be used and the way that FDA says it should be used, that's the key missing link, in addition to funding, that will unlock naloxone to get it out to the places that are the most hardest hit.
Okay, Dr. Dasgupta, thank you. So that is so helpful to understand that, and particularly in connection, Melody, with what you were saying around the steps the federal government can take. But again, let me just try to understand this. If I walk into my local pharmacy, how do I know if I'm operating at the state or the federal level?
Depends on the mood of the pharmacist. In North Carolina, for example, you can go into a pharmacy and request it. You may end up getting the nasal spray, which costs $75. You may have a copay. One of the things that happens with when you go and purchase it in a pharmacy is that there can be downstream consequences for your health finances. So we had a physician who works with us who had purchased naloxone at a pharmacy because it was something he wanted to do, wanted to have on hand. When he went to get life insurance after the birth of his child, he got penalized for having purchased naloxone in the pharmacy because it was part of, you know, a list of flagged drugs that increase life insurance rates. So it's not as simple as putting more of this on retail pharmacy shelves. The real solution is getting this into the hands of the programs and people who have the most trust with the communities that are hardest hit by the overdose problem. And these are mostly, you know, folks who are working with historically marginalized people, people coming out of prisons, people living in rural Appalachia, people who these programs that are run by and serving populations of color. And so that's really who we need to be prioritizing right now in the middle of this crisis, and not trying to send more naloxone onto pharmacy shelves, not trying to get more cops to carry naloxone, and not trying to stock every school and library with naloxone. Right now, we need to focus on the last mile.
Melody, can you weigh in here as well? It's getting clearer sort of the ways that the federal government could really be a problem solver here. Is that likely to happen?
In the CARES Act funding, there was the possibility of making these medications over the counter, and medications like naloxone could qualify in this program, and that would make it a lot easier for harm reduction groups to access the medication. So far, the FDA has used it for things like ingrown toenails and wart removers, but you know, there's the option here to put it toward maximum use for saving lives. There are also other regulatory ways the FDA could compel the manufacturing of this of these drugs. You could use the Defense Production Act, which you can invoke pretty much anytime there's a national security crisis. And with a 30% rise in overdose deaths in the first year of the pandemic, that sounds like a crisis to me. And so, you know, there are different regulatory avenues for making this more widely available, you know, from production to, as Dr. Dasgupta says, the last mile here of delivering to the people who are at most risk of dying from an overdose, which is easily preventable. It could be affordable.
Dr. Dasgupta, I will let you kind of have the last word on this. Are there members of Congress, or are there officials operating, you know, at the federal level within the FDA and other sources who are sort of carrying this, who are pushing for exactly the kinds of changes that you say can make such a big difference?
We've had really good response from the U.S. senators who we've spoken to, and we have more meetings lined up. The question isn't if we should do this, it's how. Let's figure out the mechanics. I think this is a classic situation when there is discrepancy between federal law or federal regulation and state level medical practice, that Congress is really the one that needs to step in, because FDA is tightly bound by their rules that they have to follow. So I think if Congress could pass a law that would authorize the cheap, generic, liquid injectable form of naloxone to be without a prescription requirement, that would be the single greatest thing that would help us to prevent deaths in the immediate future.
Dr. Nabarun Dasgupta is Innovation Fellow and Senior Scientist at the UNC Gillings School of Global Public Health. And Melody Schreiber is a contributor to The Guardian US. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
We've been discussing the life-saving drug, naloxone, and we wanted to know if you have had personal experiences where it was necessary for you to use this drug. Here's what you told us.
Hi, this is Neil from Ohio. I'm a former paramedic, and yes, I have used Narcan on many occasions. The interesting thing is it generally acts quickly, and the person receiving it generally responds badly. They're really mad when you take their eye away.
Hi, this is Cherie from Springfield, Oregon. In regards to Narcan, it's a new thing, you know, and I'm clean and sober for like 40 years, but in the day, I saw someone go down and die when they didn't have Narcan.
This is Pete from Oakland. I'll never forget this. Was walking to a meeting in San Francisco, saw an unhoused person lying on the ground, struggling, eyes rolling back, biting their tongue. And then saw the bouncer from the bar next door. Then I stopped, checked that the person was breathing, tried to assess how to respond, and looked over to the bouncer next door, and they calmly walked over and said, "Oh, yep, we got Narcan on hand. All of our staff are trained. Let me take it from here." And administered the Narcan. The person woke up. They may have saved that person's life that night. Everybody should have it. It's really important.
I had to use some Narcan one time as a security guard in a mall, and I was the first on the scene as I was flagged down by some people who saw some people who were acting weird, and I was talking to them, and before I knew it, they had both fallen down in the middle of the food court, and I was waiting for more backup to arrive. Basically, they had a low pulse, and we knew that they were on some kind of drug, but they hadn't been able to tell us, as they were kind of out of it before they slipped out of consciousness. We were able to get the fire department on the way, and as they were there, myself and the other security guards went through the man's, one of the men's backpacks, and we found one of the Narcan nasal sprays, and we administered it to the man to whom the backpack belonged. By that time, the paramedics had basically shown up, and they rushed the men into an ambulance and off to the hospital. I kind of regret not going to the hospital afterwards to make sure that they were all right.
My name is Deborah, and I am calling from Columbia, South Carolina. My family resides in northwestern Ohio, and they have been affected by the opioid epidemic right now. My niece's husband is in the hospital right now fighting COVID, also fighting addiction, hepatitis C, you name it, and he's not even 40 years old. He's leaving behind a 9-year-old daughter and, of course, my niece, and she has two other children that are 3 and, like, 1. And now they're onto the fentanyl. We were hoping this was going away, but due to alcoholism as well, it's hard to fight all of these addictions. It really has affected everyone in my family.
Thanks so much for sharing your stories with us. We always want to hear from you, so never hesitate to give us a call at 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or find us on social media at The Takeaway and share your stories with us there.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.